Teeing It Up with Jeremy Schilling has been going on for basically 9+ years, 9.5 years or so. Except for a show live from Israel on February 21st, 2011, we have never had a guest from overseas until right now. Joining us is a co-founder of one of the best golf websites you can ever ask for. No laying up. It is Chris Solomon, live from Amsterdam. Hello, sir. How are you?
What's going on, Jeremy? Happy Tuesday to you. I almost forgot what day of the week it was. But thank you. Thank you for having me on.
You know, it's so interesting to see somebody. And if I remember correctly, I think you're from Chicago, right? Or somewhere around that area?
I grew up in Dublin, Ohio. I lived in Chicago for 6 years before I moved to Amsterdam. So you're on the right track.
Right. And, you know, so many people who are golf fans have that 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern time mindset every Sunday in their head. For you, it's basically bedtime. I mean, for you, this is, you know, highly dedicated to be able to stay up late on Sunday night to watch all this stuff. And if, God forbid, some kind of rain delay comes, you know, you're basically screwed.
Hawaii is really tough, I'll tell you. However, most of the time it actually works out really well in my benefit. I'm usually traveling somewhere on a weekend, and I fly back into town on Sunday evenings. And I usually get home maybe sometime between 9 and 10 p.m., and coverage is really just starting at that point. So I kind of get to have a full Sunday, and then get to kind of wind down from the weekend, sit back and watch some golf, usually watch the tournament end. Chambers Bay was really hard. I think it ended as the sun was coming up over here.
Wow.
But for the most part, you know, something like Hawaii, I skipped out on the Sony Open. JT had that locked up. I didn't see the end of that. But for the most part, man, I've been kind of surprised at how well it fits into my window. Even like a Thursday night, I can come home and have time to go to the gym and then still come back and watch like a couple hours of golf before I go to bed. So it kind of works out better than I would have thought.
You know, so many of us, I think, grow up and we're watching golf and we get the itch and you know, sometimes if it's still daylight out, we head outside and smack around some golf balls in the backyard. For you, it's pitch black dark. Is it odd to be watching golf in pitch black dark?
I'm used to it now, but honestly, it makes it so much easier to sit back and watch golf. Like, when it's summertime, like in Chicago, the last thing I want to be doing on, like, a 75-degree day is sitting inside watching the end of a golf tournament. So
right. It
actually I can justify sitting inside and watching it a lot better when it is dark and basically the week is over, much more than I can on, like, a Sunday afternoon in the States. So I've been very pleasantly surprised with how much I've been able to enjoy the end of golf tournaments over here.
Especially with those Chicagoland winters, you know, when you get those summer days, you got to take advantage of them.
That's exactly right, yeah. And that's in the winters, it's easy to justify watching, like, Pebble Beach and stuff on TV, but not the case in the summer.
Yeah. All right, so we will get to the website in a second, but I think we should start with the site ambassador. What Justin Thomas has done the last 2 weeks, and obviously you've become friends with him, so you have a very unique perspective on this. The guy's hilarious. He was a part of a spring break, but he's also a darn good golfer. And it took him a while, but I think he's finally showing the flash of talent, which we have seen at times, but never with this much consistency.
I've been hyping this guy for maybe about two years now, and I didn't even see this coming. This was kind of crazy. I couldn't have pictured him being this good. 4 wins at the age of 23, 3 in his last 5 starts. I don't know, part of me always believed that he had this in him, but I just felt maybe a little too close to it and wasn't able to objectively see it and didn't really think he was going to bust through in this fashion. So what a pleasant surprise, and it's just, he's such an easy guy to root for. I know I'm tooting his horn almost around the clock these days, but it's with good reason. I mean,
Yeah. He's
a really good dude. He's a cool dude. He's exactly what golf needs, a guy that plays the game just super aggressively, but has such a well-rounded game, is a well-mannered kid, and just a really nice dude. So, man, I'm excited for what's in his future. He's got a really good head on his shoulders. He knows his capabilities, and I think he this isn't that surprising to him, and I think that's kind of what makes him pretty special, is that he's known this has been there all along, even if people didn't necessarily know that themselves or necessarily believe it. He has always believed it, and he knows he thought he should have been part of that Ryder Cup team. I know he probably doesn't. He knows that he didn't just earn it on points, and he didn't earn it with his play on the course, but he felt like he is one of the 12 best American players. I think we're going to see him on teams like that for a long time.
I totally agree. When he told Todd Lewis on Thursday that, you know, he had 206 out of the bunker and there was no way he was laying up, like, you know, you must have been smiling from ear to ear, because he really is the ambassador in that sense. I mean, that is exactly the tenet of your website.
And that's fun. I'm glad he finally, like, says it, because he'll send me a message randomly, like, after when he won in Malaysia, I may be misremembering the story a bit, but his caddy said something to him about laying up on 18. He's like, why lay up when I can make eagle and win this by 5? Like, he texted me that. Like, I've been waiting for him to say that in an actual press conference for a while now, so I was glad he finally said that one. But yeah, he is the ambassador for a reason. He embodies the lifestyle, and man, he does go for it. So yeah, it was cool to hear him say that.
What, you know, what's so interesting about that is, for people like us who watch golf, you know, every single week, we hear announcer after announcer after announcer say he's got a 3-shot lead, he should just, you know, take it safe, hit a nice little 3-iron off the tee, leave himself a nice wedge, you know, take it simple. These guys don't give two shits, and they just try to go for it, you know, all 72 holes, and I think that really is what is different about this young generation, which is playing it safe down the stretch. It's just not in their blood.
No, and I was a bit nervous about that 7-shot lead going to the final round. A little nervous on that front nine, just to see. It's just kind of that weird lead of, it's hard to still play aggressive. And I think, I don't want to project on him too much, but I think he was even a little nervous those first four holes, knowing that he didn't want to blow that lead. And I felt like he kind of flipped the switch and said, you know what, like, I'm not playing. This kind of tentative or conservative game is not fitting me well. And he started striping drivers over corners again, really going after, you know, I tried to drive 10, really went after his drive on 9. And that's kind of when the tide turned and he went back to running away with it. So, yeah, you do kind of have to stick with what got you there and not change your style of play. And, yeah, a lot of these guys play it better aggressively, even with a lead. The risks, it's almost riskier for them to lay back and start bringing in other factors into play and start playing holes the opposite of the way you're used to playing it. So go with what got you there, and yeah, it's exactly the kind of thing that he embodies.
Yeah. Question for you. Have you played golf with him yet?
I have not, no.
Because what fascinates me about somebody like him is he probably plays even more reckless in practice than he does out on tour. And that's what I think is so fascinating, is that for somebody like him who plays so aggressive, he's practiced that way too. This is not just something which gets turned on Thursday. This whole movement of guys practices that way and feels comfortable that way, which I think makes such a difference come tournament time.
I just could not believe the line he was taking on 14. Like, it was...
Yeah.
It was like he was just messing with people. Like, it didn't even matter. Like, he was aiming in between two trees that weren't in anybody else's line. And I just, there was just no fear to it. Like, even if I was his caddy, I think I'd be like, you know what? Maybe just play to the dog leg here. But he's like, nah, we're just towering it over this dog leg. And, man, that's kind of what I mean by it. I don't know if I could have really seen it coming to this extent,
because
I've seen him play really aggressive, hitting drivers off the deck and stuff like that. But with a lead, with a huge lead like that, and to still play the golf course like that, it was hilarious. I was laughing.
Yeah, and the shot, it was the tee shot on, I think, number 9 on Saturday, where it was 358 and the curve was 1 foot or something like that. I mean, those kind of things, when you can hit it so far and so straight and do it with such confidence, there's a swagger to that. And you know, this is kind of the segue to your website. The thing that I love about your website is that you're fun, you're engaging, and you do things which, you know, there are a few websites which do things like you. You had a pick up the tea counter for him at Kapalua, which was A, fantastically funny, and B, perfect because that's how much swagger and confidence he had in, you know, 2 weeks ago. He was just picking it up like that.
I think he does some of this stuff on purpose. I think he knows that I'm gonna be blowing up Twitter with the ridiculous tour sauce moves that he throws in there. But yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of golf can be a bit stuffy.
Yeah.
It's just we're just a few golf fans that like to have fun with it and, you know, push boundaries a little bit. And I think as it's grown, I've softened a lot. It's a lot harder for me to go after people and to kind of, you know, say things without people taking notice now, which is, it's a good problem to have, but
yeah.
It's kind of an interesting, weird conundrum. But, yeah, I think it's been fun to just kind of share our opinions and kind of see what it's kind of grown into and have people really kind of take notice of it. It's not something that we really expected or planned on, but, man, it's been a fun 3 years, that's for sure.
I'm talking to Chris Solomon from the website No Laying Up. He is the voice behind at No Laying Up, and the website is nolayingup.com, where you can get some fantastic shirts and hats and all sorts of stuff. Did you ever think when you started the site 3 years ago that the run you had in November and December on your podcast, having Rory, Spieth, and Bones, would ever happen?
Absolutely not. I think at two different times, I think I've been asked the question, like, who would your dream guest be? And I think I either said Bones or Rory would have been my answer. So to get to do that within 2 months, like a 5 week span or whatever that was pretty ridiculous. And I mean, really the Rory one kind of broke down the door. And it was surprisingly easy to get him to come on. And once that happened, I think it kind of, you know, I started trying to gauge the waters on Spieth, and Spieth knew that Rory had done it, so he was much more willing to do it. And you know, when you start going to people after that and say that, you know, some of these top guys have been on it and enjoyed it, laughed, and that people came away from it impressed with these guys, then it's a lot easier to, you know, pick up the phone and get the next guy arranged. So I owe a lot of it to Rory. I owe a lot of it to JT, though, too. He was the first ever player to come on the podcast, kind of break down that door of you know, this new media kind of thing where, it's definitely not the only place where guys go, players go for podcasts and whatnot, but it's kind of a new phase in the way they can tell their story, and that they may rather have a conversation with somebody for 30 minutes, 45 minutes to an hour, rather than answer a bunch of questions in a press conference. So
yeah.
I'd love to be the outlet for that and continue to keep going, but the pace we went on, I can't maintain that pace. We're going to run out of guys rather quickly. So.
You know, the Rory one was interesting because then you turn around and, like, the day after Christmas, day before Christmas, whatever it was, you break the story on his equipment. And then he hurts himself. And what's interesting about that is, from your conversations with him, were you surprised that this happened potentially because of overuse? Because it was clear that he's been testing a lot of equipment, and obviously you broke the story about the stuff he would play in South Africa. Was this surprising to you?
Surprising that he got injured?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you can really... I think any injury is kind of going to be surprising. Doesn't have a real strong injury history. I know he hurt himself before the Open Championship in kind of a fluke incident, but it's not like, and people are rushing to make the weightlifting, you know, the weightlifting take and whatever he's wearing down his body. So I would have to say yes. I didn't hear anything about it leading up into the tournament. And you know, yeah, I just don't think that's kind of the thing you can predict. I don't know if you've ever hurt. In the last few years, I know I've hurt my back, my shoulder, and I've hurt a rib before, and this stuff just kind of comes up, and it weighs on, like, everything you do, like getting in and out of bed and all that kind of stuff. And
it can come
about very quickly, and with a guy that, you know, is swinging it at 120 miles an hour, it's going to affect you. So 3 months out from Augusta, put yourself on the shelf for a couple weeks, and rest it up and try to come back and make sure you're healthy for the peak time of the year.
I have lived this because I hurt my wrist in July of 2015. I was hitting out of tall grass and did not realize that this was the type of tall plants where the club would stop and my hand would, and my hand would keep going. So I had a grade one sprain, which was essentially a strain. I was out for 2 weeks. And I came back and I was fine. And then last October, I'm at a golf resort and it was really cold. And I'm playing a pitch and putt course and I just come down on my sand wedge too steep and I feel it again. And it's like, oh my God. And it really does change the way you think about practicing and playing and turf control and swing planes and temperature. And it really can mess with your head if you're not out of your own head enough. And I totally... You know, your point is so salient in the fact that for somebody who has admitted he does not know how to properly play Augusta yet, this is not the thing he needs leading up to Augusta.
No, it's not. I think he wanted to play a lot this year leading up into it. You can't plan for these kind of things, and he's doing the right thing, shutting it down and making sure he's got it recovered in time. I'm kind of pessimistic about it, if I'm being honest. I think that word stress fracture, it's not good. It's not good. So if I'm guessing, I think he's going to be out, I would think, at least through February. I'm not basing that on anything. I don't have any information on that. But if I'm just estimating, I think he's going to really be careful coming back into this.
When you look at your life 15 years down the line, and, you know, maybe you'll get married, maybe you'll have a baby, maybe you'll have, you know, five work promotions. Where will the eighth hole on Sunday at Hazeltine rank?
I don't have any children yet, but it's going to be better than the birth of my first child, I'm pretty sure. I mean, that was the pinnacle of what was just an unbelievable in-person sports viewing experience, to have been following that match for all 18 holes and to have it just come to a crescendo at that moment was, I still think about it, man. I think I hear that crowd noise. I just reached over to my friend Kevin Van Valkenburg and grabbed him by the shoulders and screamed in his face when it happened. I know I'm supposed to be quiet inside the ropes, but I couldn't hold it in any longer. It was the greatest match to that point that I'd ever seen, and I just let it loose, and it was awesome. I mean, it was fantastic. It was I still think about it. I think the whole golf world, it was just a great moment for the game of golf. It's such a great event, and to have it all come together in one place was just awesome. So glad I could be there for that.
How soon after the Ryder Cup did you try to reach out to Patrick Reed's people to have him on the podcast?
I actually waited until very recently. I wasn't sure what Reed thought of me or if he was familiar with me at all or if he's in on the jokes or whatnot. So I didn't reach out immediately just because I was trying to play the long game with Reed, I think. But working towards it, that's for sure.
And what's funny about that is that so many people talk about the task force and all that stuff with the U.S. Ryder Cup team. And to me, they never had a central force in my lifetime to rally around. There was never the whole Darren Clark thing after his wife died from cancer. There was never the Seve one. There was never these central things to rally around. And I think what happened with Arnie's passing and then Patrick Reed coming of age and coming to be this hero, villain, Superman-like figure, I think really just coalesced at the right time for the U.S. And then with the changes the task force made, you know, we saw for those 3 days the fruit of a lot of labor and, you know, and some players finally playing in a fantastic playing environment.
As much as I want to get super excited about how bad the U.S. beat them, I think it was just a... You look at those two rosters, there was not an equal amount of talent on both sides. Yeah. And I was quite confident in the U.S. chances leading into it. I thought it went as best according to plan. I like what they have going with, you know, the task force thing has kind of been overblown, but the whole approach to the system and having, you know, basically not letting one guy run the show, not doing the Tom Watson thing all over again, getting assistant captains' input and kind of breaking down the team into not necessarily pods, but smaller groups. I like that approach. I just don't think it's like we've got it all figured out now. We're done. We are going to dominate here. Because I just think the way that Euro team fell out, there was like four guys on that team that scared me. Peters emerged as the fifth, but outside of that, there was not one single guy that scared me. So I don't know. I think it was a great result. I'd be more impressed if we see them win in Paris. I think we will win in Paris, but I think we will dominate for the years to come. But I just think the overall boils down to the fact that European team had, you know, Chris Wood, Matthew Fitzpatrick, and a bunch of guys that just, you know, did not scare me.
It's kind of reminiscent of that 99 team who had, you know, I think it was two guys for the Europeans who never played until Sunday. And when you have that kind of situation where you're skeptical of the guys you're putting in, it's hard to, you know, it puts you behind the eight ball before the matches even begin. And I think that's, you know, partly what helped the U.S. too.
Yeah, I agree with that as well.
Yeah. Hashtag tour sauce. It has taken the golf web by storm. Was this a happy accident, or was it a purposeful thing that you and the guys thought of, and it's just become this insane phenomenon?
It was actually one of the first things we thought of to get on the website when we started it. It was kind of, we built up a little bit. I think we published it in the first month, but it was actually a thing me and some buddies that I grew up playing with, wasn't even necessarily no laying up guys, and we grew up doing this kind of stuff kind of as a joke with each other, just kind of one-upping each other. And, you know, one guy backs off the shot, the other guy, like, acts like he's mad at a patron that's not even nearby, like, hold up on the cart path, please, or no cameras, please, just joking around, until we started putting it down on paper, all the different things you could do. And, like, the best one was if you hit a wayward drive into somebody's yard, you go up and sign a glove for them while they're gardening or whatever. So I started putting it on paper, and the guys definitely helped me publish it and whatnot. I couldn't have pictured, you know, 3 years later, we're still making jokes about it, and it's become this kind of phenomenon that it is. But it is kind of funny to point out the really ridiculous tour sauce moments, and it is still entertaining to me. And we still do it when we play. I mean, it's always do the fake spike mark blame and tapping down spike marks after holding one out, even though you're playing in tennis shoes. So it definitely lives on. It's been a long time coming, and it lives on a day-to-day basis.
When you play golf yourself, and let's say you're right outside your range on a hole, and you might think about laying up, do you live up to the site's mantra, or do you lay up?
If I'm playing with anyone that's ever heard of the site, I have to go for it, no matter the situation, no matter any situation. Even on holes where it's not even, I'm not even like drivable par fours, I have to be really careful when I take iron off of a par four, just because of the perception of it. So I've been in situations when it's like 255 into the wind over water, and I don't really have that shot on a consistent basis, but it's like, man,
dude,
come on. It's a pro V. Do I have to do this? Yes, you have to go for it. And sure enough, I pull a muscle trying to clear the water. But no, yeah, you're not allowed to even remotely lay up. And I mean, I do kind of have to live up to it. It's fine. I accept the criticism.
You should start, like, you know, calling yourself by like totally different, you know, like, name in public and stuff, so it doesn't seep out that you're the guy behind no laying up. It's all trapped. They're putting you in a trap to beat you and get cash off you.
There's no, yeah, when I'm with my buddies, there's no avoiding it. Like, that, I would just never hear the end of it. Like, it would ruin my reputation for the rest of my life.
One sneaky good thing which your website has is all kind of travel logs, tips, etc. How has traveling, you know, through Europe and playing around Europe been? And, like, what's been the most surprising experience you've had in terms of the difference between golf in this country and over there?
Yeah, you know, I play a lot of golf in the States when I lived in the States. I kind of moved abroad, honestly, to kind of get away from that. I think I just wanted to do kind of some different things with my life. And I've not played much golf since I've been over here, but I have been lucky enough to do one 5-day trip to Ireland, 1 3-day trip to Ireland, and 1 5-day trip to Scotland. And it just ranks up there as far as some of the best golf experiences I've ever had. I mean, I saw pictures of those places for so many years and just never really fully pictured myself getting to play them. Link-style golf is just so enjoyable. I'm obsessed with it. I'm not that good at it yet. I've had some moments with it, but honestly, I just never really thought I would enjoy like having to hit a 5-iron from 150 every now and then and flushing it and it's still not getting there and thinking that it's fun. And that's kind of been the most surprising to me. I'm kind of I don't think I'm the toughest player. I like my fairways well kept. I like my conditions controlled. But honestly, when I go play links golf, I just kind of throw my score out the window and just enjoy myself. You wouldn't believe how much fun it is to hit iron off some of these par fours that are just dead downwind and hit one 340 with a 3-iron and then, you know, come back the other way, you're hitting your drive 205. It's just such a fun, I can't even describe it. I had such a blast with my dad. We went to Ireland in October and played all up the West Coast, and it was just an absolutely perfect golf trip. So I'm just surprised, pleasantly surprised how great the pace of play is over here, how well the marshals actually keep up with it, and just how much more accepting golf courses seem to be. The whole approach of, you know, we are a private club, but you're a guest for the day, and we're going to come up and greet you on the green, and the members come up to you on the green and say, well, we don't recognize you. You must be a guest. Welcome to our club. Like, the way it goes about, they go about golf is such a better way, I think, than we do in the States. In the States, it's kind of based on exclusivity, and I think that, you know, in Ireland and Scotland, the experiences I've had have just been the complete opposite of that.
Why do you think the pace of play is better?
I don't know why. Well, A, they police it. I mean, one of my buddies and I played in Scotland at Carnoustie. We were told to speed up at one point by the third hole. Now, in our defense, it was into the wind, and we had both each lost a couple balls those first two holes. But they are on it. Like, if they time you, they have people out there timing you, and if you're not beaten here by a certain time, they're going to tell you, listen, you should be on this hole at this point. And we got a guy told us once on the ninth green to help speed up our play when we played the first nine as a 4-ball in an hour 52. So they police it so much better.
Oh, wow.
And they couldn't be nicer about it. I mean, they're like, hey, I'm not going to do the accent, but lads, I hope you're having a great day out here. Just so you know, you're 4 minutes behind pace. If you could pick up pace, that would be great. And yeah, that's just the way the golf goes there. And they don't have a card. I mean, they have cards there, but it's not really a common thing to take a card out. So you're on foot, and I don't know. It's something about it. It just flows better, and it's so much fun, man. Now you got me all excited. I'm going to Ireland in a few months. You got me all excited for it.
Sorry, my pleasure. You know, here's the final thing that I'll ask you, and I know you will be completely biased on this. Jim Nantz said last year that he thought this was Justin Thomas's year to finally contend in a major championship. He obviously did not. So here we are now, start of 2017, and I've always felt that it's so tough for people like JT or like Hideki, who plays so well at the wrong time of the year, and now you got to wait, you know, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, and try to peak again at the right time. So come April, I think it's 6th, if I'm not mistaken. But come that magical day, and that day is April 6th. What's your thoughts on your guy at Augusta?
I know you're expecting me to be totally biased in this, but here's what I'll say, is that you're right in that everything that's happening currently, like 3 months from now, really doesn't mean a thing. All right? He's going to be, I don't want to say he's going to be just another one of those guys, but like he's clearly on a huge hot streak right now. I think his chances have improved for Augusta, but I don't think of them that differently than I do currently. Augusta is such a unique golf course, and I do think it sets up well for him. He has told me in the past, He loves he's very confident he's going to win a Masters. Let me put it that way. I don't disagree with that. My only thing is that I think Spieth is going to win the Masters. I've been saying it from the highest mountaintop. I think I'm going to take him every year, probably for the next 20 years, to win the Masters. But it is a early part of the year. It is a full field event. He just won, but we don't have the full group of guys here. We don't really have Dave played at Kapalua, but we don't really have Dave playing full time right now. Phil hasn't won in several years, but he's a different animal when it comes to Augusta.
Scott's back in Australia.
Yeah, we don't have that full slate of guys out there yet. The whole landscape is going to look different 3 months from now. Do I think he can contend? Absolutely. We haven't seen him really contend in a major. I know he finished maybe sixth at the PGA in 2015, but he's not played in that many of them, I know, but it doesn't change a whole lot for me for a major, just because it's 3 months out. The hot streaks don't last 3 months. He could go, he could cool off for a while and get hot again, of course, but I just don't think whatever's going on right now correlates that well with what's going to happen at Augusta. It's not like Kapalua. I mean, Kapalua with the elevation change a little bit, but it's not like Kapalua and Wailea are that similar to Augusta, if you ask me. So.
And as Phil always says, something happens between Wednesday at Augusta and Thursday at Augusta. When you come back to that golf course the next morning, something is just different. And, who knows how he will fare when that additional pressure, stress, and excitement starts to pump through his body. Chris Solomon, who is one of the founders of the No Laying Up website, please check it out, folks. It is just fantastic. Thanks so much for coming on Teeing It Up, and thank you for doing this from overseas. I truly appreciate it.
Jeremy, thank you for having me, buddy.
And that is today's Teeing It Up. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you.